You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, with COVID-19 cases rising again around the country, some hospitals are running out of room and resources to care for patients. That's raised a question: should unvaccinated people go to the back of the line? A UW-Madison expert says no. Find out why and share your thoughts. Now, earlier this year, the hope was that September would bring a return to normal pre-pandemic life. But around a lot of the U.S., that's not really happening. And the Delta variant is a big part of the story. Big companies, Apple's, Facebook's, Ford's, and others were planning on returning to the office right around now. Instead, they've pushed that back to early next year. Restaurants and retailers are scaling back hours because their workers are staying home, in some cases, worrying about being exposed to COVID-19. Other businesses say factories are operating at reduced capacity. And even though in-person school is back, so are mask mandates, and it's anyone's guess if classes or daycares will be disrupted again. It's all part of what our next guest is calling the I don't know economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been affected by this economic uncertainty again? Have you gone back to the office? Are you still working from home? If you're able to work at home, if you work in person, are you worried that things aren't getting back to normal as soon as you had hoped? If you're a business owner or manager, what have the past few months been like for you? And hey, parents with kids in school, do you think they're going to stay in school? Are you worried about how you're going to work your work life around kids maybe having to come back home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, one of your pieces on this recently, the I Don't Know Economy piece, we had this hope, I think a lot of us, that September, we're going to be pretty darn close to normal. Can you talk about all the I don't know that we're feeling right now?
Yeah, you did a great job listing it out. The biggies are obviously this, I don't know. So executives can't tell you when their products are going to be back on the shelves or when more cars are going to be in the lot or whether we're going to have enough toys on the shelves for the holidays because of all these supply chain glitches that continue. Obviously, the school and the daycare factor, a lot of concern. It's sort of the fall of chaos, I call it, where okay, your kid is back in school for now, but what can happen next week? Are you going to get that phone call that says, sorry, your child's been exposed, please come pick them up ASAP? And then if you're a worker who's been working from home, I'm part of that category. I just received a notice from my company saying, hey, we thought we'd come back later this month or early October. Now we won't be requiring everybody back till January. And of course, that has ripple effects on that. I was just driving through downtown Washington, D.C. is still mostly a ghost town. And even people are seeing it. I tried to go to my bank on Saturday, and I learned that the bank is now closed on Saturday that I use because partly they don't have enough staff to keep it open on the weekends in the way that they used to. And I think so many of us have had that experience of going to our favorite coffee shop or whatnot and seeing that sign on the door that either says, sorry, we don't have enough staff, please be patient, or it says, hey, sorry, we close early now.
I want to key in on one group you just mentioned, parents with kids under 13, unvaccinated kids, especially the moms. You quoted a Federal Reserve of Atlanta bit of research. Women with children under the age of 13 accounted for 19% of the pre-pandemic workforce, made up a disproportionate 30% of job losses. And now you're writing about, you were going to the school year, and that mom sending the kid to school is trying to decide, can I go back to work? Can I assume that my kid's going to keep going to school in the next month or two or three? What are you watching for there?
We're already seeing it. So we just got that data on Friday called the jobs report for August, and 90% of the jobs, of the 233,000 jobs created in August, went to men. And so where were the women? Well, a lot of these women are moms who were still trying to figure out what is the deal with school right now or with childcare. You know, are things stable enough for me? I had interviewed a woman who was like, look, you know, I've got four kids. One of them had just gone off to university in Louisiana and she had to go pick him up because of Hurricane Ida. You know, another child was, you know, at a place where they were having a war over the mask mandate at the school. And so all of this was sort of coming to the forefront. She's like, I'm trying to get back to work. I'm trying to search for a job again, but it's really hard to do that right now when I'm still juggling all this chaos that's going on. I would just make one other point, even beyond the childcare issues, and that is this is starting to have an impact on the economy. We are seeing a slowdown in hotel and airline flights. I know people are tracking those TSA, everybody's favorite, the security guards, you know, going through the airport. They track how many people have been going through. That took a real nosedive in August as the Delta variant picked up. And similarly, we see restaurant bookings, OpenTable, that app has been sharing a lot of their restaurant booking data throughout this pandemic. Things had almost rebounded. At the end of June, it almost looked pre-pandemic-esque. And since late July, when that Delta surge, you can just see this drop-off in reservation bookings. And the biggest one of all, and this is where I feel it, and so many people feel it, I can't wait to hear some of the calls, sentiment in August, what's called consumer sentiment from your neighbor there at the University of Michigan, they put out this monthly survey, and in August, it fell to the lowest level, the most pessimism of this entire pandemic.
Wow.
So even worse than sort of March, April, those first horrible months in 2020 was August. And I think it's just what we're talking about. So many of us, and I'll put myself in that category, kept thinking, if I can just make it to September, if I can just make it to Labor Day 2021, you know, things will start to feel normal. My kid will be back in school. I might be back in an office. You know, I could maybe go to the art museum or to the sports ball game again, or the high school football game. And, you know, it's not quite like that in many parts of the country.
Talking to Heather Long from the Washington Post about what she calls the I don't know economy, with the Delta variant of COVID-19 raising lots of questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you feeling worried, uncertain, skeptical about the big picture economy, the economy of your own life? Have you put out going to a new job or going back to your old job? Have you put off travel or other things that you spend money on because of the uncertainty right now? And hey, what about parents with those unvaccinated, unvaccinatable at this point, kids at home? How's that affecting your decision making? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mark is with us in Hartford. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just kind of more so had a comment that the pandemic really changed my outlook and kind of the work-life balance. My work went totally remote, and when we were told that by July we'd be full-time back in the office, I quit, and I found a job where I could stay completely remote, and I couldn't be happier. I think that the push for companies that, like, their culture is so important, we got to get back to the office, feels like a joke compared to lose it, you know, being able to ditch the commute and, you know, all the office politics and that kind of stuff. It feels great for me.
And Mark, I just want to ask before we let you go, did you not want to go back because you were still concerned about COVID and the safety stuff? Or was it, hey, working from home is awesome, you don't want to go back, COVID or no COVID?
Honestly, it was kind of both.
Okay.
I definitely had some COVID concerns. My wife is... she's got some immune issues, not, you know, nothing big, but just, you know, get sicker than normal. So there were some concerns there, but it was, you know, it just in gas savings, it saves me, you know, $120 to $160 a month just in gas money.
Wow. Mark, thank you so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Heather, Mark is not the only one doing this calculus of to go back or to quit. What are we seeing out there?
Exactly. I wish you could see me nodding so vigorously. First of all, I'd love to know if Mark's an introvert because I feel the same way. It's been great working from home if you're more introverted. But beyond that, he illustrates this bigger point, which I think you and I've talked about before. I had written a piece in the spring where I said it's not a labor shortage per se. It's a great reassessment of work in America. And I just hear Mark's story over and over again, whether people are white collar workers or blue collar workers or new collar workers, or whether they were working retail or what, so many people have said that this really changed them. This pandemic, it really psychologically changed them, what they want out of life, what they want out of their job, how they want to work, and where they want to work. Maybe, maybe it's at home versus in an office or outside. I've heard some people say, I want a job that's more outside. And that's been a huge problem for employers as they're trying to react to the fact that so many people, it's not that they don't want to work, but they want to work in a very different type of way and environment than they did in, late 2019.
We are talking about the uncertain economic future, the uncertain economic present for that matter, in the midst of the Delta variant of COVID-19. Heather Long stays with us, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. She wrote a piece recently about the I don't know economy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you feeling uncertain about what's going on with the Delta variant and the economy overall? And is that affecting decisions you make in your life about your job, about your travel, about what you're willing to spend money on and do in person? And parents with kids in school, especially kids under the age of 13 who can't get vaccinated at, what is on your mind? Is that affecting your job planning, for example? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the I don't know economy with Washington Post economics correspondent Heather Long. She recently wrote about the Delta variant and why it's causing a lot of economic uncertainty across the U.S. She says the pandemic is making it hard for businesses, employees, parents to predict what life is going to be like in the weeks and months ahead. And you can join in maybe with your own story at 800-642-1234. If you're working at home, don't want to go back. If you're working in person, worried about what you're seeing in your workplace. If you are a parent or a student or a teacher, what kind of open questions do you have about whether things are going to keep rolling in person as we kick off this new school year? Join in with your thoughts, experiences, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Heather, you mentioned those big new job numbers that came out last Friday, and they weren't as big as people had predicted or hoped. What is going on there?
Yes, it was this huge sigh, sort of gasp when that data came out on Friday. I think people expected it to be a little bit weaker. You have to remember that over 1 million jobs were added in July and almost 1 million in June. And then, so most people thought, okay, maybe that, comes off the gas a little bit in August after the Delta variant. Instead, the final number, I think I misspoke earlier, it was 235,000 on Friday. So a quarter of what we had been seeing earlier in the summer. Obviously the main story is this Delta variant was putting a huge pause on a lot of hiring. It was crazy to see that the hospitality sector, which had added the bulk of the jobs, basically half of the jobs in the last several months, instead added zero in August. If you dig into the data, restaurants actually lost a couple thousand jobs, and there were very, very weak hiring in sort of the hotel and entertainment sectors. So, a lot of that screams. Retail also actually shed jobs in August. So a lot of that is very much a direct impact of this, I don't know, we've been talking about. Why should restaurants, if you're in the middle of Washington, D.C. and you're a restaurant, it's clear that a lot of these workers, lawyers and bankers and, you know, lobbyists are not going to be back downtown. So, of course, you're not going to beef up the hiring like maybe you had hoped to do this fall. The other one that I keep pointing out that's a real glaring error that ties into a lot of what we were talking about earlier is there was also lost jobs in the childcare sector. So we continue to see real struggles to hire in teachers back to the classrooms for K through 12, and an even bigger struggle to hire daycare and childcare and after school workers. Obviously, without those people back in place, there's even less place for the kids to go, and that makes it harder for parents to get back to work.
Yeah, people have been pointing toward a mismatch, Heather. We've got unemployment, not as bad as it was, you know, like last year, March, April, whatever, but not back to pre-pandemic levels, still higher than it was before. But we've got businesses reporting a labor shortage, saying we're not able to bring people in. How can you have one and the other at the same time?
Yeah, this was actually the most read article on the Washington Post over the weekend. The headline was literally why America has 8.4 million unemployed when there are 10 million job openings. So just what you're talking about. I've been thinking about this for months and talking to unemployed folks almost every day and talking to employers. And here's the three best answers I have to that quandary. This great mystery. Number one is you use the word mismatch, and I would use that too. If you look at where the most job openings are right now, they are in sort of business, professional services, education, and the health sector, and then leisure and hospitality. But if you look at the last job the unemployed right now held before the pandemic hit or before they lost their job, it's only about half the people had worked in any of those sectors. And so you have this mismatch where, you know, if somebody's looking for someone with experience, whether it's to be a chef at a restaurant or even a waiter, or whether it's to, you know, do accounting in the business sector, you know, they want somebody with a few years of experience. And right now there just are not enough people with that kind of recent experience. The second thing I would point out is we still have over 3 million people in this country who've been unemployed for 6 months or more, in some cases over a year. We know historically it's hard to get those people back into jobs. It just takes more time the longer you've been away from work. So, you know, we'd expect some of this hiring to slow a little bit here in the fall. The last thing I would point out, you know, obviously people say, oh, what about unemployment insurance payments? Obviously those went away this week. Those are mostly going away now. But I would point out is the other important factor is I hate to blame computers, but so many of the hiring is done online now. And what you hear is these companies have outsourced their hiring to these robots. And what's happening is robots are looking through resumes that are submitted on like an Indeed job site or LinkedIn, and they're almost too good. They're looking for such specific keywords that they are excluding basically millions of potential employees because they don't have that perfect wording, you know, in their resume or on their LinkedIn profile. And it's become a real problem. And I would encourage employers to really rethink what their screening process is.
Talking to Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post, talking about uncertainty in our economy during the Delta variant phase of the COVID-19 pandemic. Still time for you to share your own uncertainty. The number is certainly 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You know, Heather, early pandemic, I heard from a lot of economists saying, you know what, this isn't a choice between COVID safety measures and the economy. The route to fixing the economy is to fix COVID. Is that still true now with the Delta variant?
It's definitely still true. And we obviously just saw it in August with that weaker hiring. If you look at actually that Labor Department report on Friday, they also have been asking questions of people like how many are working remotely, you know, working from home as opposed to in the office. That number jumped. It was the highest so far in 2021 in August, which is, you know, okay, you could argue some people were on vacation or trying to work from the beach or their shore home or their lake home. But, you know, for a lot of people, it was this renewed fear, just like your caller Mark was talking about earlier, of not wanting to be out and about as much anymore. And you know, so similarly, seeing those airline traffic and the restaurant bookings go down. So yeah, I think the big concern is if we can't get this under control pretty soon, and we're all hoping that this is, we're going to follow the UK's path where there was a spike and then it starts to subside, you know, by the middle or end of September, that would, you know, be a huge relief for everyone. But if that doesn't happen, I'm particularly worried about what we were talking about, that consumer sentiment falling so dramatically in August, people describing a sense of hopelessness. You know, and when they feel hopeless, they tend not to go out and spend a lot. Obviously, spending is you know, 70% of the U.S. economy.
In our last minute, Heather, what are you watching for next with all of these moving parts here?
There are many moving parts, indeed. Number one is that sentiment we were just talking about. We cannot have people feeling hopeless and this hopelessness. And you know, obviously, number two is what's going on with the COVID cases, hospitalizations, and vaccinations. And number three that I'm really keeping my eye on is, can we get these childcare centers and schools to open and stay open? It's been very alarming to me to hear from so many childcare owners across the country, childcare center owners, who are telling me, I cannot hire anyone, or the people I used to hire now work at Walmart or at McDonald's.
Heather, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you.
Heather Long is an economics correspondent at The Washington Post. We talked to her today about uncertainty in the national economy, in large part, in most part, because of the Delta variant of COVID-19. Also looked at last week's disappointing jobs numbers that came out for the month of August. Still time to share your personal economic outlook. Are you worried about going back to a workplace? Have you changed what your workplace is? Are you one of the long-term unemployed people Heather just talked about a few moments ago? Let us know. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Again, that's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin public health researcher says people's vaccination status should not play a role when hospitals prioritize medical care. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's Brad Kohlberg bringing us a story about watching chimney swifts at dusk.
We all have a lot of things to cross off our to-do list. Have you taken out the trash? Are the bills paid? Laundry folded? And if you're writer Catherine Jago, have you paused and turned your gaze skyward at dusk to witness the dance of the chimney swifts?
On August 31st, I hear that the chimney swifts are roosting in the brick chimney at Our Lady Queen of Peace Church. At summer's end, swifts mass in great flocks at dusk as they prepare to migrate south. My husband and I resolved to go there after dinner. It isn't an auspicious evening, cloudy and spitting with rain. We're bickering as we get into the car, anxious we'll be late. We arrive at 7:10, and I scurry ahead, clutching my binoculars, in search of the right chimney. I see nothing in the sky. We come to an expansive parking lot at the back of the church. Some minivans have pulled up, and people are sitting next to them on lawn chairs, chatting companionably. Two women are lying face up in an empty paddling pool. There are kids of various ages tooling around on the blacktop on bicycles and scooters, impervious to the drizzle. We join a small knot of birders gathered around an elderly gentleman in a wheelchair, wearing a tweed hat with a plaid woolen blanket tucked around his knees. I see only two swifts, tiny and high up. They look like cigars on wings, with the same rapid fluttering as bats or scraps of burned paper. But as the minutes pass, they multiply as if conjured out of the air. Now I can hear their high, sweet chittering. For a while, they swirl around in all directions, but gradually they cohere into loose ovals, the skein bulging this way, then that, above the rooftops. The old man is as excited as a boy. "Mother and I never saw this many," he exclaims, pointing skyward with a tremulous forefinger, his enthusiasm infectious. "Another first. Pretty good for a 91-year-old, his daughter says, affectionately. I keep checking my watch. Our necks begin to ache, gazing up. Sunset is at 7:34, although tonight it's only a glow in the dense cloud. As 7:30 approaches, the chimney seems to exert a magnetic attraction. Individual swifts dive towards it. Most pull out of the turn and veer off, but the odd one vanishes. At 1 minute before sunset, the flock's loose swirling picks up energy, like water circling around a drain, and suddenly they're pouring themselves down the chimney as if down a funnel and vanishing. I imagine the commotion inside the chimney, hundreds of small birds jockeying for a perch on the masonry with their tiny claws. I wonder if they prefer certain spots, higher up or lower down, and how they all get into such a tight space without colliding or hurting one another. When all of them are gone, there is soft applause. Someone says, "Sleep well, guys." I stand leaning into my husband, who has his arms around me from behind. When I turn around, people are dotted all over the parking lot in twos and threes, staring up, smiling. They have appeared out of nowhere, like the swifts. It wasn't a spectacular sunset, or a spectacular number of birds, 300 or 400 at most. But there's a collective sense of peace and pleasure. I resolve to come back at dusk, whenever I can, before they leave.
Catherine Jago is a translator and writer whose most recent poetry collections are Bloodroot and News from the North. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, COVID-19 cases continue to rise around the U.S., and that means hospital beds are filling up again. With health systems at or near full capacity in many communities, some are being forced to plan for potentially rationing medical care like they did in the early days of the pandemic. This time, there's a new question being considered, whether it's ethical to make unvaccinated people a lower priority when a hospital has maxed out its resources. This doesn't seem to be happening, at least not yet. One health system had an internal email raising the question. There have been newspaper editorials, though, calling for that change. Our next guest says it would be the wrong move. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the medical community should consider when deciding whose treatment is a higher priority when hospital resources may be overwhelmed? How would you feel if an unvaccinated loved one was turned away or moved down on the list for medical treatment? Or if a vaccinated loved one couldn't get life-saving care for a non-COVID-related condition, for example, because local hospital beds were full with unvaccinated COVID-19 patients? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Tiffany Green is an economist who teaches in the departments of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison. She wrote a recent op-ed for the Wisconsin Examiner titled "Punishing the Unvaccinated is the Wrong Medicine for COVID-19. Tiffany, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Can you start by talking about just situations when hospitals might have to start deciding who gets care and who doesn't when they're overwhelmed by something like COVID-19?
Yeah, so as we're seeing in the news, hospitals are filling up quickly. There are many places where hospitals just are running out of ICU beds, in large part because we don't just have COVID, we also have other conditions for which people also need to go to the ICU. And unfortunately, there are times when we don't have what we need, or we're getting perilously close to it.
And as I mentioned, the idea has been at least floated, not so much, I think, within the medical world, but by some outside, saying we don't want our resources tied up for that person having a heart attack or a gallbladder attack or you name it, by a person who made a decision not to be vaccinated. You're worried about that, though, as you wrote in that piece in the Wisconsin Examiner. Why do you think that's the wrong road to pursue?
I'm worried about it because people who should probably know a little better are saying these kinds of things, you know, rumblings on the internet. And I'm surprised because while it feels good, I can understand how, you know, you can have a bit of schadenfreude, you know, when people who are publicly anti-vax rail against COVID and they end up getting COVID and getting very sick or worse. So it's understandable, right? But I think it that we see the world in black and white, and we want to believe that this decision to get vaccinated is this very simple individual level decision, and it's simply not, right? We, as I talk about in the op-ed, there are so many reasons why people don't have vaccines, and it's not just because they don't want to get one.
And let's get into that now a little bit. Who are you seeing who's unvaccinated, but not necessarily because they're anti-vaccine? What are some of the obstacles they may face?
And, you know, I just want to talk a little bit. I usually don't do this, but I'm going to talk a little bit about my personal experience.
Sure.
As you might imagine, I think I'm pretty good at doing research and finding resources. But I can tell you that the only reason that I got my vaccine as early as I did is because another PhD-educated friend told me about where to go on Facebook. And in that group, I was able to find resources to get to luckily get in somewhere sooner because of that, right? And I thought about that and I said, man, I can only imagine how people that don't have ready access to the internet, that don't have friends to tell them where to go, might not find it as easy as we think. And so while we don't have that same rush on vaccines that we had before, we still have a lot of factors that determine or make it harder for people to get vaccines. I have a car, but a lot of people don't have cars. And if there are only certain times when vaccines are being offered, then it's hard to do that if you have to work, right? Or you have to use public transportation, which is highly inconvenient, or you don't have a job with flexible work hours. Another important aspect that we're not talking about is the connection between our social safety net and vaccination. So we think, oh, people don't want to get vaccinations because they don't want to suffer the side effects. Well, as most of you who have taken the vaccine know, at least my experience was, I got knocked out for at least a full day after that second dose. It was very temporary, but I have the ability to stay at home from work, right? If you don't have a job that has sick leave, as many people who work jobs don't, then you don't have time to suffer the effects of the second vaccine, the second shot.
I don't usually share my personal experience either, but I also got laid up for a day, and I was thinking about, glad I could be off work for a day. Glad my kids are old enough to take care of themselves too. Is that the childcare issue part of the obstacle here for someone who doesn't want to risk being laid up for that day to take care of maybe infant kids instead of advanced teenage kids where I was?
I mean, I think, you know, I have colleagues that have been talking about this for a long time, but the pandemic has truly laid bare how work is gendered in this country. Every academic mother I know, and not just mothers, fathers too, but we could see, you know, it's always, you know, the challenges with finding childcare, the challenges of, you know, somebody being quarantined and having to take care of kids at home and work at the same time. It is a lot. And the expectation that someone be able to take off of work while still having to deal with childcare is really enormous. And, you know, all of this is not to say that no one is ever responsible for their decisions. But I'm arguing in this op-ed that these decisions do not occur in a vacuum. And if we really want to get at the underlying roots of this, of the under-vaccination or non-vaccination of a wide swath of the U.S. population, we have to look at the structural factors that are driving it.
We're talking to Tiffany Green from UW-Madison's Departments of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology. She's with us today to talk about the ethics of moving unvaccinated people down on the priority list as hospital beds again start to fill up across the country. Healthcare workers confront the need, in some cases, to ration healthcare resources. Our guest says that's not a good decision make, moving them down on the priority list because of their vaccination status. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Do you think the medical community should consider vaccination status when they have to triage who gets care when they're getting overwhelmed? Do you have questions? Do you work in healthcare yourself? Love to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation and take your calls coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about rationing medical care as COVID-19 cases grow across the country and whether healthcare professionals consider a person's vaccination status when deciding who gets care and who doesn't, who's where on the priority list when hospitals get overwhelmed. Tiffany Green stays with us from UW-Madison's Departments of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Pat on the line in Three Lakes. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I feel this way about it. If you don't get the vaccine because of religious purposes or because of health purposes, you should be prioritized the same as the person that's got the vaccine. But I've seen a whole bunch of people in this community and other communities that don't get the vaccine because of political purposes. Now, if you have somebody that comes in and they got the vaccine and they had this, you know, sometimes it's difficult to get it. And somebody that says, hell with it, because I don't believe in it, because I'm I'm whatever you are, political persuasion. Why should you treat those two people the same?
Pat, thanks for the call. Tiffany, what would you say to Pat?
I would say to Pat that I understand how he feels. It's really frustrating as folks who we've sacrificed quite a lot during this pandemic. We've gone on lockdowns. We've gotten the vaccine and still we can't get out of it. And it's in large part due to both people that can't get vaccinated, like our children, and people that on the surface have chosen not to be vaccinated. But what I would say is that goes down a dangerous route. For example, Pat talked about people who have religious objections, but some might say, well, why are religious objections different from political objections, right? That's, you know, it's a dangerous road to go down. And I also think that, you know, as I say in the article, when we think on the surface that it's going to be, it's a fair thing. But even in the beginning of the pandemic during COVID, we started the thought was to triage people that were at risk for poor outcomes. And that ended up being disabled people, older adults, right? Somebody could argue, well, somebody is unvaccinated, but they might do better than an older adult with a vaccine. So what I'm saying is not that people are not responsible for their choices, but that we take a really broad view of the unintended consequences of doing something that we think is fair.
Thanks a lot for the call, Pat. We'll go to Steven now in Milwaukee. Steven, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my question is, and you just kind of alluded to this, but I would counter this argument with, this isn't very different than patients that are on a transplant list. So there's certain patients that are just ineligible due to maybe disability or other issues for transplants, as there's a limited amount of resources and there's more patients than there is resources. We're entering this era or this time in the pandemic where we have less resources than we do sick patients. So how is that different?
Steven, thanks for the call. And I hear, and I'm not no expert on this, but I hear, you know, with a liver transplant, that person who drinks alcohol and won't stop knocks themselves off the list, or at least way down the list. Tiffany, is that a valid comparison?
No, I don't think it is. I don't do transplant research, but I can tell you from having the good fortune of having colleagues that are engaged in this space, is that you see a lot of inequities come into the transplant space as well. People that are low SES having less access to foods that are consistent with maintaining good kidney health. Black and other people of color are less likely to have living donors, which is again more consistent with a long life of the kidney. All I'm saying is that these aren't individual level behaviors. You know, people act in individual level ways, but the environment is what shapes our choices. And it's very easy to say, I made these choices, why can't they? But if you read the article, I do discuss a lot of the reasons why these choices aren't individual. And I also would argue that a lot of disabled people took great exception to being deprioritized, as they should have, as if their lives were less valuable because they were disabled. I think that's ableist and it's problematic. And it's inconsistent with having a society where we value all of our members reaching their highest potential.
Stephen, thanks for that call. We're talking to Tiffany Green, researcher at UW-Madison, looking at how hospitals allocate resources when they get overwhelmed by COVID. The idea floated, not in practice anywhere that I know of, saying should unvaccinated people be bumped down on the priority list? Back to your calls now. Eric is with us in Kaukauna. Eric, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Eric?
Well, I just think that, you know, they shouldn't really discriminate on how, you know, people that aren't vaccinated, because they might have religious beliefs, they might have personal beliefs, you know. And, you know, I guess part of the reason I'm not really too into it is the government backs so you can't even sue them if it hurts you in the long run. So I think that bothers a lot of people too. You know, I mean, I don't think that you should have just a group of people that pick and discriminate, because, I mean, as far as our society's going, we're trying to eliminate discrimination, and now you're letting certain groups of people that are probably the ones that discriminated before.
Eric, thanks for the call. Tiffany, you get into some of this, you know, people who are in some ways victims of misinformation, and that's why they didn't get the vaccine. You have sympathy for them that some people have written op-eds don't.
Yeah, and I have to be honest, I had to dig deep. I don't want your listeners to think that I am not sympathetic to their points of view. I have small children that are too young to be vaccinated, and I am afraid for them and other people's children every day. I want to make that clear. And I do think that we all have a responsibility to get vaccinated for those of us who cannot. You know, this is infectious disease is not something that we can drive by individual level decision making. I think that policy approach has been really problematic. And as we've seen, very ineffective in getting people to get vaccinated. But I would say in the short time that we have left, that we can't expect people to just accept the COVID vaccine when we've allowed the anti-vax movement to thrive and to flourish for many years. You don't just erase that kind of misinformation. You don't allow misinformation to thrive on social media and then expect because, well, you know, obviously you should get the vaccine. Well, to some people, it's not obvious. You know, and put on top of that, the way this vaccine has been politicized. And I think as scholars, we have not always been as diligent as we could be in educating people about the scientific process, which people are seeing play out in real time. You know, I can understand why some people would still have doubts. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be vaccinated, but that we have to have a long-term strategy for addressing disinformation on the internet and elsewhere, and doing the work that some people are doing in the communities to one by one to answer questions and encourage people to get vaccinated. That's not a short-term strategy, and it's hard because the house is on fire now. But I think that we really have to buckle down and address this long-term, because the next pandemic will certainly come, particularly given all that's going on with the climate.
Tiffany, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tiffany Green, an economist who teaches in the departments of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about whether it's right to consider if someone is vaccinated or not against coronavirus as hospital beds fill up and health systems contend with deciding who gets care and who doesn't. Her recent op-ed on this for the Wisconsin Examiner is titled, "Punishing the Unvaccinated is the Wrong Medicine for COVID-19." You can find it linked at wpr.org/centraltime.